like to welcome you to Haynes this evening. We are very privileged to have four distinguished visitors to our campus, although one of those four will probably be familiar to most of us. David Goah is the director of the Chester Ronning Center in Camrose, which is part of the University of Alberta. And David has been working with Haynes to bring a number of very significant speakers and topics to our campus. You might remember a couple of weeks ago, we were privileged to meet a mufti, to shake hands with a sheikh, and hear some wonderful Sufi chanting. We've also had a consultation on religious schools at the college, which has also been co-sponsored with the Ronning Center. And we consider it a great honor at Haynes to be included in these kinds of events, because the burden of the Ronning Center is very much our burden, which is to talk about the public voice of religion within Canadian society, and how religion both contests the public, but also makes a contribution to public life. And I think that's very much what our topic is going to be this evening. I want to introduce the other three distinguished guests that we have. And maybe I'll just do all the introductions first and we can get those out of the way. Archbishop Lazar is the abbot of the Monastery of All Saints of North America and the civil liaison of the Canadian Orthodox Archdiocese. We will actually have another chance to hear the Archbishop address us on the whole question of orthodoxy and science, which will be very, very interesting next month in December. He has published on the topic of the relationship between the Orthodox tradition and science, as well as numerous other publications. And we're greatly thrilled. Is this the first time that you've... Okay, not the first time?
Here before.
Okay, excellent. Good. Next to Archbishop Lazar is Dr. James Payton. Dr. Payton has been at Haynes for a couple of days, and he's been speaking to us to commemorate the 500th anniversary of the birthday of some dude named Calvin. You know, he sounded like a really interesting guy, and I'd really like to know more about him. Yesterday, we heard a very interesting lecture on Calvin's piety. A side of Calvin which we're maybe less familiar with, because he's often stereotyped as the one who propagated this idea of predestination. Today we also heard a lecture on Calvinism in Eastern Europe, which told a story which many of us were not familiar with. So we're very pleased to have Dr. Payton with us. He is professor of history at Redeemer University College in Ancaster, Ontario. And he's someone who is very interested in the Orthodox tradition, and particularly in dialogue with Orthodox Christians and with Muslims as well. So I think this is will be a very interesting conversation with Dr. Payton this evening. Next to Dr. Payton is Dr. Ibrahim Abu Rabi, who is the Chair of Islamic Studies at the University of Alberta. And we've had Dr. Abu Rabi here a couple of times, so I'm not sure that we've had you come to speak. You translated.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
2 weeks ago.
That's right, 2 weeks ago, yeah. Before he came to the University of Alberta, Dr. Abu Rabi was the co-director of the McDonald Center for... That's MacDonald, not McDonald. For the study of Islam and Christian-Muslim relations at Hartford Seminary. For those of us who are followers of Jesus, we're particularly interested in Dr. Abu Rabi, who was born in Nazareth. He is from Palestine. We come to appreciate very much the insights that he brings to us, not only into Islam, but also into that part of the world which is so important for the three faiths descending from Abraham. What we're going to do is each speaker will talk for about 15 minutes, and once the three have spoken, then there will be an opportunity for them to respond to each other, and then we'll open it up to conversation from the floor. So, with that in mind, I will hand you over to Archbishop Lazar.
Well, for speaking about religion and culture and civil society in general, probably the Orthodox Church has had the most experience with it, and it hasn't always been a positive experience. When the Roman Empire stopped persecuting Christians and finally Constantine the Great accepted Christianity as the sole religion, it was still the Roman Empire. Consequently, no one could imagine there not being a state religion. It was simply woven into the whole fabric of the Roman Empire and the Roman experience. And consequently, Christianity was replacing the long-established religious part of the state of the Roman state. Now, most previous religions had been able to sort of merge together because they had a pantheon which was easy to identify one with the other. Christianity was radically different. It didn't have a pantheon. And consequently, the persecution of Christians was partly because people thought that Christians were essentially atheists because they didn't have a pantheon and they didn't have several state gods. And it was natural to Rome, though, that Christianity, once it was recognized, should become a state religion also. And consequently, the Orthodox Church entered into a relationship with the Roman state, which at first was described as a symphony. There would be a harmony between church and state. The church would govern in the spiritual and moral realm, and the state would govern in the civil realm. But it's impossible for something like that to actually work, because the state is the most powerful and a stern mistress. And when you begin to want the state to legislate your beliefs into civil law, then the state controls your religion, because now it's civil law. And this happened within the Roman Empire. And so when we come now to the point where the Byzantine Empire, which was really the East Roman Empire, is gone, and the various empires in Eastern Europe are gone, and we step back and take a new look at the relationship between civil society and the church, we realize that becoming a part of the civil society itself, becoming entrenched in the government or having the government act as an agent for your religion, is extremely destructive. And from drawing from our own historical experience, I will say that I prefer personally to have a secular state. I prefer to have a secular government in which we can manifest ourselves in a spiritual and moral context. And when I say a moral context, I'm not talking about, you know, I often say that morality is a heresy. Morality is a heresy because it's so often a substitute for a life in Christ. You know, we have this rule and this law, and maybe we follow this rule and this law, and that's fine. But it doesn't speak about any kind of inner transformation. And when we talk about real moral movements in society, we have to remember that the Canada Health Care Act was of Christian origin, that it was a Christian manifesto to begin with. The great T.C. Douglas and his colleagues were Baptist ministers, after all, and they initiated the Canada Health Care Act based on what they read in the Gospel. And the First Ecumenical Council in the minutes, First Ecumenical Council of when the church was still united, mandated a universal health care system throughout the empire. And that really on the initiative of the Empress Helena. And that universal health care system was the responsibility of each diocese of the church. So Basil the Great built a hospital so large it was called the City of Basil. And the tradition of unmercenary physicians began very early in the church. We have this tradition of saints who are called unmercenary physicians. Two cousins of Apostle Paul founded the movement, two women, Philomela and Zenais. And so the tradition was founded in the time of Apostle Paul. And that's what we're talking about when we're talking about moral leadership in society by the church. We're not talking about persecuting people who don't see eye to eye with us, which has been far too often the actual problem. And moral leadership in church is about the fullness of humanity. And I'd like to give just two examples of it. The 25th chapter of Matthew's Gospel, to me, sets out our real moral program in society. At St. John Chrysostom, that chapter begins with the parable of the wise and the foolish virgins. And St. John Chrysostom, when he's giving a sermon on that chapter, those three parables in that chapter of Matthew's Gospel, are all seamless. They all go together. You can't possibly understand one without the other two. And the whole story is what you have to look at. And Chrysostom asks, what was the oil that was missing from the lamps of the five foolish virgins? So they were all virgins, so they all had equal virtues. And they all had some kind of faith because they took lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. But the oil that was missing from their lamps was the oil of humanity. They had no humanity. All the virtues in the world were useless without humanity, having your lamps filled with the oil of humanity. And this is the real moral leadership that the church should be giving in society. And we cannot give it when we're merged together with the state, because that's not what the state is interested in. And the church keeping itself as free from the state as possible. The other problem is that when we live in a society in which we have many religions, including atheism, we cannot try to use the state to enforce our position and our perspective on how society should operate and run and how the state should operate. We have to not say that our religion predominates and therefore we're the first-class citizens and everyone else is a second-class citizen in the state. We're faced with now standing back and looking at the history of state churches in Eastern Europe and seeing how extremely difficult it was for us to function within the framework of the gospel itself and to have a life in Christ when the state was enforcing our dogmas as law, and we then, in turn, were expected to enforce absolute loyalty to the state. And it compromised so much of what we were supposed to be trying to do in society. Not in every case. Of course, there were always people who were willing to be a little bit outrageous and stand up for what the gospel actually taught, instead of looking back and trying to find things in the Old Testament that you could use to hurt people with. They were actually looking at the gospel to see how you could help people. And consequently, I would present the idea that in our relationships with the state, we try to represent what we think is a real moral value, but we have to weigh that and say, are we trying to enforce this because of an ideology we have instead of a living faith in the gospel? Are we trying to have a religious ideology enforced? Are we presenting a religious ideology? Or are we presenting a living faith in Christ? My first teacher, Father John Romanides, once told us that religion is a neurobiological illness and faith is its cure. Because our religion becomes an ideology and we try to merge it with the state because we think our ideology should be what the state is governed by. And we think that our ideology is what everybody should accept and endorse. And consequently, we lose the spiritual value of what we're trying to teach and the actual value in terms of opening our hearts to humanity all of humanity, wherever we find them, in what condition we find them, regardless of their religion or their race or any other, with the parentheses or hyphens we put around people, and opening our hearts to them as humanity. The mystery of redemption, from our point of view, is the mystery of co-suffering love. It has nothing to do with Christ dying on the cross to satisfy God's justice. It's the mystery of co-suffering love. And co-suffering love of Christ for mankind calls upon us to imitate the same thing and to realize that, first of all, human passions, the word passion doesn't mean sin, it means suffering. And one of our primary concerns has to be with the issue of inner human suffering and the suffering of other people, and realizing that the tragedy of one person is the tragedy of all of us, and that the inner human suffering of one person is something that's a mirror image of our own inner human suffering, and that we have, first of all, to reach out in a healing way toward first inner human suffering, but toward all human suffering, and that when we have tried to have a moral influence in society itself and in the state, then first and foremost, it shouldn't be with trying to whip people into the kind of behavior that our law tells them that should be the code of their behavior, but looking at the problem of human suffering and how that human suffering can be healed. You know, the ministry of Christ on earth was not a juridical expedition. It was a healing ministry. Everything he did, except the wedding, at the wedding of Cana, where his mother's intercession changed the order of God's plan, every other miracle was a healing miracle. And Christ showed us that healing the whole person was the real gospel message, and that that healing was our obligation and our duty. And a part of that is recognizing ourselves and the sufferings of other human beings and responding to that suffering instead of making it worse because of a religious ideology that we've fallen into that has corrupted our faith in Jesus Christ and our life in the gospel. And so in terms of our relationship with of our religion in the state, not just in a state where we have a multitude of religions, but even if we were the sole religion in that state, if we were going to be truly followers of Christ and of his gospel, then we would struggle constantly against falling into an ideology. And a moralistic ideology that's the worst kind of all, because a moralistic ideology is what brings us to exterminate or kill off other people. The pogroms, the inquisitions in Spain, all these were just the fulfilling of a religious ideology, of a religion that was merged with the state. And it was a horrible experience and a horrible blot on the history of humanity. And so we need to free ourselves from being a religion and a religious ideology and become faith communities who have genuine faith in Jesus Christ and not faith in an ideology that we've created in connection with the state in which we live. And that's really my perspective on it.
I'm aware, as I look at my interlocutors and think about what we're talking about, I'm in a bit of a tough situation. From the Orthodox perspective, Eastern Europe, Russia especially, Byzantium, that's not had a lot of influence on shaping the West. The Muslim community, not yet either, shaping North America. North America has been shaped by, if we talk about religious cultures, the West. And if we think within Protestantism of, especially the influence of John Calvin, whom I'm supposed to be representing during these days, that means that everything that's wrong and the few things that are right in our culture is perhaps my fault. Now, it's not really my fault. But as we think about the West and the culture in which we live, about the society in which we hope to be able to function, we are thinking about a culture that was shaped largely by some Western Christian approaches, and especially by certain Protestant interests that in some ways are drawn back regularly to John Calvin. Calvin and his teachings seem to especially catch on with the upwardly mobile middle class that was rising in the cities. It caught on with the merchant classes in Britain. It caught on famously among the Dutch. And many scholars, not with the best of arguments, but nevertheless surely, have tied Calvin to the development of Calvinism, of capitalism and the spirit of capitalism, such as Otto Weber. Similarly, Calvin has been credited or blamed with the development of what's called democracy in the West. And again, with greater or lesser credibility, nevertheless, many emphases in the kind of governments we live in have been traced back to the kind of things he said. But what strikes me as somebody who studied Calvin a lot is that the further we get from Calvin, the less obvious are the influences that came from Calvin himself or from the Reformers. What we have in our culture in the present day, by the time we get even to the 20th century, is a culture in which a whole lot of things have been done that Calvin and the other Reformers could never possibly have foreseen, probably would not have planned, and most likely would not have endorsed. Nevertheless, in North America as we live it, certainly if we're going to talk about our three cultures and heritages, it's the larger Western Christian one that's had some influence on shaping the cultures of the U.S. and Canada. Even so, there was a movement about a century ago, perhaps a little bit more, that developed, especially in the Netherlands, that's had some significant purchase in other nations, in other regions of the world, called Neo-Calvinism, as spawned by Abraham Kuyper. The particular party with which he was associated was, in translation, called the Anti-Revolutionary State Party. And what the revolution that was in view was the French Revolution, which had cast off a variety of constraints, including Christianity. And what Abraham Kuyper was looking for was not a reinstitution of a state church or some kind of domination of a government, but a reintroduction of Christian civilization, of Christian approach to cultural questions and state questions, as over against the increasing secularism that any virulent secularism that had been spawned in the wake of the French Revolution. And so what Calvin called for, among other things, was that Christians should become more aware of their faith and their piety, to learn how that influenced and shaped all they did, thought, and engaged in, and to make that conscious for them so that they could be a salting influence in culture. They could be a light set on a hill, but so that they could influence culture, not to make it into a form of state religion again, but to play an equal role with the other varieties of cultural expression, the other religious orientations that were there, including Catholic works, Catholic circles that were very prominent in the Netherlands as well, and the atheist or more obviously secularized culture that had arisen in the meanwhile. So Abraham Kuyper and what came to be called Neo-Calvinism urged that Christians should play a significant role as Christians in society, in culture, and eventually Abraham Kuyper was elected Prime Minister of the Netherlands. Unfortunately, just at the turn into the First World War, which made it pretty difficult to implement much more of the work that he perhaps had in view. But what Calvin called people to, or what Abraham Kuyper called people to with Neo-Calvinism, and what we who call ourselves Neo-Calvinists have said since, is that Christians should be involved as a countercultural movement, challenging whatever the reigning assumptions are, pointing out Christian implications of what we see in the Gospels, in the Scriptures, and trying in our own ways to live in a way that's responsible, reflects our culture, bears witness to it, but then working with others. Interestingly, Kuyper didn't set out to create a kingdom. He was serving in one. The kingdom belonged to the Lord Jesus Christ, who is the King of Peace, not the dominator of others. And Kuyper wanted and called Christians to be involved in cooperation with others in a pluralist situation in which there would be, through elections, some parties that would win, some would have majorities, some would have greater numbers, some would have less, but they would all work together for the welfare and of the entire culture. Things have changed. The pluralism that Abraham Kuyper faced in the early 20th century is a very different kind of pluralism now. And interestingly, we'll get back to that in a minute, this Neo-Calvinist movement, which I've spoken, has changed as well. It's been interesting for me as someone who grew up outside the Dutch tradition, outside the Calvinist tradition, but has now been drawn within it, it's been interesting to me to look on and see some of the ways in which this movement that has helped shape King's University College, where we're having the meeting this evening, Redeemer University College, where I teach, and many other institutions as well, not just academic ones. It's been interesting to me to look at how neo-Calvinism has moved in its own significant directions, from the extreme right to the very accommodating left. There are groups calling themselves neo-Calvinists who are theocrats. They look for a theocracy in which Old Testament strictures and rigidities would be imposed if they ever came to election and came to power in government. Now, that is a fringe, a minority. But some are there, and they've certainly departed from from Kuyper's perspectives in that regard. I think, though, most neo-Calvinists recognize that we need to work to try to bring Christian influence to bear on cultural questions, on questions of all kinds, from the economy to healthcare to politics to social work to caring for the poor to questions of peace and war and justice and all kinds of things. But we are living in a very different kind of pluralist society than what Abraham Kuyper experienced and probably envisioned. When Kuyper and the neo-Calvinist movement that gave birth to such institutions as King's and Redeemer and all these other things that we've talked that I have in view, when Kuyper was operating and neo-Calvinism was spawned, pluralism included basically historic Western European stuff. Catholics, some Lutherans, some Calvinists, Mennonites, a whole bunch of secular atheists that had drifted in from after the French Revolution. But basically it's all Western European stuff, all influenced by, shaped by Western European prior experience that had been largely shaped by and influenced by the Western Christian tradition and by the influences that have been brought to bear through it. Let me use a couple of examples here from North America and in the English language. It's remarkable to realize how much, over the centuries, English literature has been shaped by the King James Version of the Bible. There's no doubting that. And it's been abundantly shown in a number of studies just how pervasive that influence has been. But that cultural heritage that is part of Western European and North American experience is something that's certainly being dissipated, not just because the King James Version is no longer used so much, but because the general kind of cultural heritage or cultural awareness that was dominant for centuries is disappearing. When I was going to grade school and high school in the United States, I grew up there, I'm a dual citizen now, but I've been living here for 25 years. When I was growing up in the United States, in the Midwest, in Illinois, in a public school, if you referred to Psalm 23, everybody knew what you meant. If you referred to Moses or Noah, everybody knew Old Testament, Ten Commandments, flood. If you referred to the Apostle Paul, that was not a mystery. If you referred to Jesus, everybody knew. A few weeks ago, surveys were done with college-age young people in the United States. Did you know that Sodom and Gomorrah were a married couple? And when it went on to detail some other elements, it was shocking just how illiterate Western European, North American culture, rather, has become as over against what had been the pattern so recently, even just a few years ago. This is not just in North America. A couple of years ago, I read about an art historian from university in England who took his class, upper-level students, to the local cathedral. And as the tour guide there was giving them a very basic tour, the art historian asked his students if they could say what the significance of the cross was in Christianity, because it was hanging at the front of the church. Not one knew. And then they had questions about the funny little bird in the picture of Jesus being baptized. What's happened is that that heritage that we used to be able to think was part of the West, that Kuiper could draw on in the Netherlands, that has undergirded so much of what has been the case in North America, is by and large gone and is not likely to return. We're living in a pluralistic society in which not only has the prior heritage been forgotten, but now we have as our neighbors peoples who don't share that heritage at all. Not only the influx of immigrants from Eastern Europe and other communities of Orthodox heritage, which wouldn't have had that same particular kind of background, but now we have people from all kinds of religious traditions, all countries of the world, Muslims, Hindus, Sikhs, Buddhists, whatever it may be. And the kind of pluralism that Neo-Calvinism was originally spawned to deal with is not the pluralism in which we live in North America. And I would like to pick up on something that that Archbishop Lazar said and say that, yes, I resonate with what he affirmed. I think, as a Neo-Calvinist myself, that it is not a matter of having the majority group of whatever religion it may be getting its way first and foremost. That since there are more, perhaps, Christians or Western Christians in Canada, then we get to set the tone for religious community and everybody else has to take a second place line or a third place line. If we're genuinely going to have pluralism in our culture and we're going to be able to speak as religious communities within that, it's not a matter of counting heads and tallying up votes. It's a matter of respecting and treating each other as those who similarly have concerns for the well-being of society and culture, who live next door to each other, practice different religions, but are seeking the welfare of other people, taking care of the poor, the needy, trying to make the society function in a way that respects that all of us are citizens. It's not first and second class citizens, but all of us are citizens. And that will mean, for those of us of the dominant heritage, dominant background, stepping back and not asking you a special pass. And this means that we can need to learn to work together with others of religious heritage, of very different from our own, but also of non-religious heritages, if we're going to have a civil society, Neo-Calvinists and others, must learn to work together respectfully as equals, as those who bear the image of God, as those who are created by God, as those who have been placed here in this community to live with each other in a civil way. Thank you.
Good evening. We have been given only 15 minutes to talk about very complex issues in relation to religion and state, and I've been asked to talk about the relationship between religion and state in Islam, which is extremely vague to me. And I have chosen not to talk about the long Islamic tradition of political philosophy, that's to say what Islam and Islamic texts have to say about the relationship between God and man, or between political elites and religion. Instead, I want to talk about the modern and contemporary Islamic situation in a select number of Muslim countries in order to clarify the relationship between Islam and state. And as you well know, Islam has become a Western problematic. That's to say that Islam is not just an Islamic issue, but to say the least, since 9/11, Islam has become a problem for many Westerners. What does that mean in a sense that Islam has been extremely misunderstood by many Westerners? And although we have large Muslim communities in the West, I think that Muslim communities by and large, have failed to explain Islam to Western people, because I believe that Muslim communities in a Western position have been ambivalent about their own position in terms of Islam and their own societies, let's say Canadian society or American society. And I'd like to clarify that from different angles. But let me start by saying that when we talk about the relationship between Islam and the state nowadays at the present time in the Muslim world, I believe we can discern three distinct positions of the relationship between Islam and the state. The first major position I would call the conservative Islamic position that is represented by most of the Gulf states such as Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, and so on and so forth. Those states believe that Islam and the state are intertwined. But I do believe, and I'm going to explain that in a second, this is the first model, the conservative tribal Islamic model that we see it nowadays in the present day Gulf states and certain states outside of the Gulf such as Jordan, the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, or Morocco, the Kingdom of Morocco, which has been ruled by the same family since the 1600, since the past 400 years or so. Now, the second major model of the relationship between religion and state is what I would call the secular model in the Muslim world, and this is very true in Turkey, in Egypt, in Syria, in Pakistan, and I'll talk about Pakistan a bit today because of the current civil war in Pakistan. The secular model of Malaysia as well as of Indonesia. Now, the third major model is the model where a religious clergy is in charge of the state. And the only state in the Muslim world where clergy are in charge is that of Iran. Because Iran, since 1979, since the Islamic Revolution of 1978-79, has been ruled by a clergy. And of course, in the recent elections, we have seen a major crisis in terms of the relationship between clergy and religion in Iran. But still, the clergy are the most powerful class, ruling class, in present-day Iranian society. When we talk about the first model, the conservative Islamic model, in the Gulf states, let's take Saudi Arabia as a major example. And why Saudi Arabia? Because Saudi Arabia holds the most important Islamic holy places, Mecca and Medina. That's where Muslims do a pilgrimage every year to Mecca and Medina. So Saudi Arabia, although sparse in population, is a significant and central Muslim country. In many ways, it is much more significant than Indonesia, the largest Muslim country in the world, or Pakistan, the second largest, or Egypt, the largest Arab country in the world. Now, Saudi Arabia is very significant. It is also significant because since 1792, there has been a major alliance within Saudi Arabia between a religious movement called Wahhabiyya, and nowadays Wahhabiyya is very famous in the West, but that doesn't mean that we in the West understand the historical theology of Wahhabiyya and the vision of Wahhabiyya. But there has been a historical alliance between a religious movement that was founded in the 18th century by a certain Muslim theologian by the name of Muhammad Abdul Wahhab, who died in 1792, and between a tribe, the Saudi tribe, the Al Saud, the family of Saud. And that alliance has been very strong since 1792. Except of late, in the past 40 years or so, we have begun to see certain rifts, certain divisions within that alliance. And I want to give you one prime example. When we talk about Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, many of us perhaps did not hear about Osama bin Laden 10, 15 years ago, but he's become famous, an international person on the scene since at least the tragic attacks on the USA in 9/11. If we look at the narrative, at the biography of Osama bin Laden comes from within the Wahhabi sect, the Wahhabi ideology and the Wahhabi theology. That's to say that the disagreement, his own disagreement with the Saudi monarchy is not because of secularism or Arab nationalism or Sunni Islam, but it is because there has been a crisis within the Wahhabi establishment within Saudi Arabia in the past 40 years or so. So he is the product of that Wahhabi extremism. And that's why there's no doubt that he became extremist himself, because he came from a radical Islamic Wahhabi extremist movement that is part and parcel, even until now, of the Saudi regime and Saudi society. Now, if you look at the family, the Al Saud, the Saudi family in Saudi Arabia, by and large, you know, the family is quite large. We're talking about 20,000 men and women. in that family. And I would say that by and large, the family is very religious in public, but it is not religious in private. And this is mainly because it has been a wealthy class within Saudi Arabia, the wealthiest section of Saudi Arabian society, that has taken advantage of religion in order to advance its own commercial or political or family interests in the area as well as outside of the area. And, you know, the claim that the Saudi family is not that religious, I would give one major proof, which is its own alliance to the West, especially the USA, in the oppression of its own people in the past 50 years or so. As I said, there has been a major crisis within Wahhabiyya and its own alliance with the Saudi family in the past 40 years. And this type of crisis nowadays has led to some funny things in Saudi Arabia itself. The fact that Saudi Arabia, for the first time in history, is able to send Saudi female students to the West to study. Let's say they are sending students to the University of Alberta. I mean, you might say that this is a good sign that female students from Saudi Arabia are free to travel and free to study, which is good in a sense. But they have done that under the pressure of the American political elites. And they have sent, in the past two or three years at least, 15,000 students to the USA. Nowadays they are sending to Canada. In addition to this, their own belief of late in what we call interfaith dialogue, that had never been on the agenda of Wahhabi Islam in Saudi Arabia. And that's why a large number of Wahhabi ulama are really upset with the current family, the Saudi family, because they believe that the Saudi family is driving Islam away, or society away from Islam, and that the family is not keeping to its alliance with the Wahhabi movement. That had been the case for the past 200 years or so. Now, so that's, you know, some major ideas about Saudi Arabia and the first model of the relationship between Islam and state in the Muslim world. Now, the second major model, as I said, is the relationship between secular regimes in the Muslim world and religion. And I want to give you a number of examples. I think that the most famous example in the West is the example of Kemalist Turkey since the Turkish independence, the creation of the Turkish state in 1924. That's to say, the creation of the Turkish secular westernized nation. Now, in Turkey, as you well know, religion has to be taught by the state, although the state has defined itself in a secular way since 1924. Religion cannot be taught by autonomous Islamic seminaries or Islamic schools or even Muslim individuals in mosques. You are not allowed in Turkey to teach Islam even in a mosque, independent of the state. That's to say that the state has been in full control of religion, religious establishments, and religious ideas and religious education since the time of Kemal Atatürk of 1924. Of course, nowadays we see major shifts because the current party in power in Turkey is religious in nature, and it will take some time, I believe, another 50 years perhaps, to change the secular course and direction of the Turkish state. But let's take another major example too, the example of Indonesia as the largest Muslim country in the world. When Indonesia won its own independence from the Dutch in 1945, it won the independence in the name of Indonesian nationalism, not in the name of Islam, not in the name of Javanese nationalism, but in the name of Indonesian nationalism. But, of course, we know that this type of experience came to a halt back in 1963 when Suharto came to power. And Suharto, in a sense, uplifted the religious element and sentiment within Indonesian society. Nowadays, we are not sure whether Indonesia is a Muslim state or a secular state with a larger Muslim population in the world. And this is very true about Pakistan. You know, in Pakistan nowadays, as I said initially, there is a major civil war against religious political elites and religious leaders in Pakistan, the what we call the Pakistani Taliban. And the fight is, to my mind, is about the nature of the identity of the Pakistani state. Because the Pakistani Taliban, in a sense, want to Islamize Pakistan. They want to create an Islamic state out of Pakistan. But Pakistan has not been sure about its own identity since the partition of 1947. That's to say that I believe that there is a major conflict between the identity of the nation-state of Pakistan and some major elements within Pakistani society, not only Taliban people, but those who support the spread and dissemination and the expansion of the madrasa-type mentality in present-day Pakistan. Now, I would like to talk about the last example that I mentioned, where the clergy are in power, the example of Iran. And before I forget, of course, we must not forget that we had another example until December of 2001, which was the example of the Taliban in Afghanistan, because the Taliban were also a religious community, a religious class of people, students of theology, who had been in power in Afghanistan. But in both cases, in the case of Iran of 1979 until the present time, in the case of the Afghanistan and the Taliban, I think that both societies had been in severe crisis. And that's why in the case of the clergy of Iran in a sense emerged in order to save Iranian society from the crisis of Pahlavi Shah secularism that had been in power for 50 years or so before the coming of the clergy, the ulama in Iran, to power. So in a sense, the coming of the ulama in Iran to power had been a response to the crisis of the nation secular state that the Shah of Iran and his father before him had been trying to establish in modern Iran from the beginning of the 20th century until the collapse of the Pahlavi regime in 1979. And this is very true in terms of the Taliban. The emergence of the Taliban in Afghanistan had been a response to a society in crisis, a society that had been in crisis for at least 20 to 30 years of its life, even before the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in December of 1979. And that's why the Taliban responded to that crisis by offering an Islamist solution to the social, economic, and religious crises in modern Afghanistan. Now, what does that mean to all of us nowadays? It means that neither the Taliban or the clergy of Iran would disappear anytime soon. And I believe that a military solution, Pakistani style or American style, is not the solution to the problem of the relationship between religion and state in the modern Muslim world. In this case, between the Taliban and the Afghan state, that's not the solution whatsoever. Now, I want also to talk briefly about one major eccentric example in the relationship between state and religion in the contemporary Muslim world, and that's of Iraq. We know that under Saddam Hussein, under the Ba'ath regime, and even before the Ba'ath regime, Iraq had been a secular Arab nationalist nation. With the American occupation of Iraq in March of 2003, one of the major consequences of that occupation had been giving Iraq, the nation of Iraq, to a religious community. That's to say that the central government of Iraq nowadays is controlled by a Shiite religious class that had been trained in Iran, that is similar in perspective and vision to the Iranian clergy. And as a matter of fact, a large number of the people in power in Iraq nowadays are Iranian citizens because they had lived in Iran for at least 20 years of their lives. That's to say that this is, to my mind, this is an odd contribution of the American occupation to Iraq that I don't think that the Bush administration had ever intended to give Iraq to a religious Shiite establishment. And that's what has happened since the American occupation of Iraq. And I would say that in many ways, the Shiite Iraqi regime and the Shiite Iranian regime are similar in vision and orientation, and perhaps we might see a certain type of alliance, if not unity, between Iraq and Iran in the future if the situation were to persist for a long time. Now, I would like to talk about one last point in a brief way, although this is very multifaceted and complex, which is a point of the presence of Muslim communities in the West. And I want to talk only about one facet of that relationship, that here, let's say, in a city like Edmonton, I was told that we have over 70,000 Muslims, most of whom have immigrated from different parts of the Muslim world. But the oldest Muslim community here in the town had immigrated from Lebanon, from Ottoman Lebanon initially, and then from Lebanon that was controlled by the French Mandate and present-day Lebanon. Now, in my interaction with the Lebanese Muslim community here, I'm not talking about the Christian community, it's very clear that in terms of their own identity, Lebanon comes first. And perhaps Islam comes second and Canada comes third. But this is not true with the children who are, with the Muslim kids who are born in Canadian society in Canada. Because to my mind, I'm talking about religious Muslim kids who are born in Canada, to them a certain form of Islam, authentic Islam, comes first, then Canada second, then the countries from which their parents had migrated comes third. So there's that conflict in terms of identity between those who are born overseas and those who are born here in Canadian society. That's one major point that we must bear in mind. A second major point I'd like to highlight about present-day Christian education in North America as compared to present-day Muslim education in the Muslim world. Since I used to teach in a Christian seminary in Hartford, Connecticut, the USA, in the USA alone, there are 250 seminaries that teach Christian education and that are independent of the state. Those seminaries, institutions are independent of the state. They do not receive any financial aid from a state, from the local state or the federal state. In that sense, they have the freedom to train their leaders in a free and independent way. But this is not true by and large in the Muslim world. In the Muslim world, there has been a major struggle between the three types of states that I have mentioned, the conservative state, the secular state, and the clergy state, to control religion and control religious institutions, that's to say, to control religious education in their countries. That's to say that Islamic education in the Muslim world is not that free. Very often it is controlled by the state. And very often it is not supplied or financed well by the state, and that's why these institutions of Islamic learning graduate ill-paid imams or teachers who cannot think in a global way about, or even local ways about, Islamic issues, and who cannot engage their audiences in a contemporary way. And therefore I would say that there's a major crisis of Islamic education because of the lack of independence of religious institutions in the Muslim world. And this is one of the major problems that we have to deal with when we look at the relationship in the three different models that I have presented, the relationship between Islam and the state in the present Muslim world. Thank you.
Speakers, and we'd like to give you an opportunity to respond to each other. We haven't really structured this in any way, so you know, if we were to be really anal about it, we would have to make sure that everybody had a chance to respond to everybody else. But why don't we just have you go? And are you happy to go in the same order? And just pick up a thread or two threads that you heard from the others, and
No, I was just thinking that the beginning of the reign of the Ayatollah took place with
speak
Muhammad.
It doesn't work. No.
Okay. No, I was just thinking that perhaps the rule of the Ayatollahs in Iran became predestined with the overthrow of Mohammad Mojaddegh in the beginning. That the next
in the 1950s, you mean, 1952.
Yeah, but the succeeding regime would have pushed people much more deeply into an Islamic frame of mind.
Yes.
After than the Shah's reign, because of course, like the Saud family, wasn't terribly pious. But that conflict with religious education is something that also played itself out in, say, the Russian Empire, where there was a constant struggle between the schools and the state. And that it's something that we kind of experienced as well. And it's, I just wondered, well, you've seen that a lot of religious institutions in North America do get support from the state in some places. And I wonder how you would view whether they were compromised that way or not in any way.
Well, as far as I know, the 250 seminaries do not receive financial aid from the local.
No, the seminaries don't, but yeah, the private schools do.
The private, yes, but that's a difference. I'm talking about seminaries where they train religious leaders.
Yeah.
That do not receive fund, and they are independent, so to speak, of the state. But this is not true in the Muslim world. In Pakistan, as you well know, there's a major conflict nowadays between those independent madrasas and the state, and the army.
Yeah.
It's not the state, it is the army is struggling against. And the army, in a sense, symbolizes or embodies Western modernization, so to speak. Mm. So the army cannot tolerate independent, especially independent Islamic voices.
Yeah, that's pretty well the truth in Turkey too, wasn't it, under Kemal?
And Kemal, it's changing a bit now.
We share that one too, by the way, in Turkey, trying to reopen the Halki Theological Seminary.
Well, they permitted that last year. I mean, the government has permitted that.
Yeah, that's what I
mean. Yeah, yeah.
Just so you're clear on this, there was a large Orthodox seminary, educational institution in Turkey on an island, actually, the ways to Istanbul. And with the new government, which has a religious bias, that is, over against the deeply secular bias of the Kemalists, that Orthodox religious institution is allowed to open for the first time in how many years?
Since 24.
Since 24. So when a government comes in that particular circumstance, which, I mean, you can characterize it, I can't, but it isn't virulently secular. Mm-hmm. It's not like the French Revolution Tuesday after Madame Guillotine came to town. Then the openness to religion actually goes across the board. It becomes more pluralistic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you hear? Did you hear anything in each other's remarks that caused you to ponder the things that were of most concern to you in what you said, each of you said? I mean, the one thing that I sure wonder about, Professor Payton, you really spoke about the exhaustion of Christian capital. Mm-hmm. Within our culture. I call it a kind of culture of amnesia that has taken hold. And this, my sense is that this has a civil effect. That one of the things that happens in our society as a result of that is a lack of capacity to actually engage other religious people from other traditions. That is, it creates an uneasiness with people of other faiths. It doesn't do what I think the intention was in the 50s when we began to strip out the content of Christian tradition and culture from the curriculum. The intention certainly was the only people that can really be tolerant of others are the people that don't care about anything.
Yeah.
But I think clearly this is absolutely the opposite of what really takes place. I mean, in my own work, I find that the people with the greatest elasticity of mind, the greatest capacity to engage and enjoy others, are the people with the deepest formation. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, part of Archbishop Lazar and I were with you, of course, in Syria. And I must admit, I became quite depressed when we came back, in part because it seemed to me that in Syria there was a kind of seriousness about the religious life, and I know Archbishop Lazar commented on this, a seriousness about it, which I haven't seen here in years. It was striking.
You know, David, when I speak at universities in America, and well, sometimes in Canada, not only the West Coast where we have more of a pluralism, I often ask the you know, I can get away with a lot of religious stuff because of the way I dress. And as I say, as soon as people find out that I'm not a recruiter for Hogwarts, I ask people how many of them are raised in a Christian family, and it's approximately 90%. Of the students in the class. And how many of you still consider yourselves to be Christian? It's about 4% or 5%. And afterwards, I like to engage them a little bit and ask them why they rejected Christianity. And the models that are formed are across the board. I mean, they're kind of general answers that I get. And of course, the trouble is that the loudest Christians you hear are the ones that we wish nobody would ever hear. You know, we do have our Shiite or our Taliban Christians, and
Wahhabi Christians.
They're the ones that have the loudest voice, and generally they're trying to use Christianity to beat somebody over the head with, or to use something from the Old Testament law, and very seldom looking at the Gospel of Jesus Christ. And the other thing, of course, is this artificial conflict that they've created between science and religion. And ultimately, you end up with fundamentalist teachers who will tell people they don't mean it that way, and that's not the words they're using, but they're saying you have to choose between truth and God, but you can't have both. You have to choose between reality and Christ, but you can't have both. And ultimately, that's the message that comes through, even though that's not what they say and not what they desire to say. But in fact, that is the truth. I mean, that is the issue. I mean, there are other issues besides, but that's one of the major issues, is that, you know, it's people insisting that the Earth is 10,000 years old when everybody knows very well it's around 4.5 billion years old, and insisting that you can't be a Christian if you accept the actual age of the Earth. Well, that's a big issue with people because they're really having truth pitted against God. And that's among our major issues. But those are the Christians who are heard the most often and the loudest. And I suppose that's part of the problem with the misunderstanding of Islam, because, after all, who gets the most press? It's Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. The rest of Islam doesn't get much press. And we suffer the same thing in North America. And part of the reason that we've lost... If you look at why the ancient church conquered the Roman Empire for Christ and what we're doing now, there's no relationship between what we're doing and how we're interacting with society and how the ancient Christians did. Remember, one of the main complaints against Christianity by the Romans was, I think it was Pliny, wasn't it, who started the persecutions in Cappadocia first. He once commented that Christians would not be so dangerous if they cared only for their own. But what makes them so dangerous is they care for all without respect. And that's one thing to make Christians dangerous.
Yeah, he was really angry that Christians were feeding his poor, not just their own poor.
Yeah, and the other thing, of course, is moralism has replaced morality.
I would like to pick up on one other thing that Ibrahim said here, and have you expand on it a little bit. You talked about the shift that's taking place among Muslim young people. And you characterize that their parents identify as Lebanese, Muslim,
Pakistan,
Canadian, or the equivalent. And that what you're suggesting is that within the young, there is a pulling forward, or at least among some, a particular kind of understanding of Islam that is giving them some I don't know, thicker identity. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big issue, but I believe that we as Muslims in the West, we still do not have our, I would say, appropriate religious leadership in the West. I mean, if we look at the local mosques here in Edmonton, and I know 5 or 6 of them, the imams have been brought from overseas. And some of the imams, even after spending 5 years in Canada, still cannot converse in English. That's to say, it's not a matter of English only, but it's a matter that they even cannot understand Canadian culture or Western culture, especially because Muslim kids are born in this culture. They are part and parcel of this culture. So I believe that there is a crisis of Muslim leadership here in the West. There is a crisis of identity, and I believe that we as Muslims have not talked openly and honestly about these challenges that face us in a Western society. And I believe also that the conversation would be enriched if Muslims were to speak in a serious manner with Christians and Jews and Hindus, whatever, in this type of society. Because, you know, from the way you talk about Christianity, or Steve talks about Christianity, we face the same challenges and the same issues. The issue of secularism, or the issue of religious education in a secular society or nation, or the relationship between religion, local religion here, and religion back home, so to speak. So these are fundamental issues that we, as of yet, have not talked about in an open and straightforward manner as Muslims in the society.
One of the other things that I've heard from a few of the colleagues in the Muslim community, and it goes back to a comment Fadika made as well, is that so much of the media portrayal of Muslims is, of course, in the midst of the terror of history.
Yeah.
These awful things that are occurring. And as a result, a number of young people within the Muslim community, seeing that, say, I don't have anything to do with that.
Yeah.
It becomes a secularizing factor in their life. Not unlike the issue of particular kind of spokespersons for wings of the Christian church, which are equally virulent. And when that then becomes, it's taken up in public discourse as norm, and it becomes actually part of the process of secularization of children.
Yeah, it forces the secularization because people just can't tolerate, can't stand or can't live with that kind of extremism.
That's one dimension. But the other dimension is that since 9/11, if we talk about Muslim communities in the West,
going the other way,
religion has been strengthened within Muslim communities.
Yeah. It's a way of identifying over against.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right.
Raymond. Yes, this whole question about secularization, like why has our society lost its memory, as you say, of Christian vocabulary. And I think there's several reasons, but one of them, I believe, is really caused by the church. Christianity, for generations, centuries, becoming associated with dogmatism and often anti-life movements and anti-science, so that it has made itself irrelevant to any curious truth seekers amongst the young people. So of course they've lost that knowledge of biblical stories. Why do they want to learn these biblical stories if they feel that this has given rise to religious institutions that are irrelevant? I know lots of young people, admirable, intelligent young people, who don't, they don't have this knowledge of the tradition, and the fault lies not in the state, for instance, in the government, it lies in the church. I mean, we don't need a long catalog, we all know how the treatment of women, there's so many issues. And when it comes to the education, religious education, I don't think it's possible to have a kind of religious education that would be liberating until it's got to be done by the state, but it has to be an education that's all races, all faiths. And as long as the church or denominations have felt like religious education means our version, which in the West is Christianity, has to be the subject. And that's not going to work.
Okay. Professor Clayton,
You have been part of a school founded fairly recently.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty serious.
Mm-hmm.
How do you respond to what Raymond has to say? And how do you see your work and what you are doing, and I think of King's as well? Here we have a couple of examples, and I think they're counter to what Ray is saying, but engage that. Think about that a little bit with us.
Yeah, I think in that regard, for example, to go back to Kuyper that I mentioned before, Kuyper was encouraging Christians to think seriously again about how their faith impacts more than just their private piety and what goes on Sunday. And in speaking in that fashion, he was speaking into a void that I think has existed just as much in North America. However much we may talk, for example, in the United States about a city set on a hill or the Christian founding fathers or all the kind of things that are periodically stated, typically North American Christians have not been trained to think in a Christian fashion. They've been trained to think in a North American fashion with a lot of Bible. And what the Neo-Calvinist tradition has tried to do, what King's and Redeemer and other institutions are trying to do as well, is help raise the consciousness and awareness that Christian influence and Christian impact on matters is not just a matter of a little bit more Bible information or finding your latest Christian Taliban to tune into in the late night television programs, but to engage in some thinking out of the heart of the gospel, thinking out of the heart of the kingdom of Christ, and what does it mean to be a responsible citizen in our day, not in whatever it was that existed 200 years ago or 250 years ago in your imagination. So I think what we're trying to do is trying to be relevant, not because of the situation that's developed in the last 50 years, but in spite of it. And I think what's developed indicates just how desperately Christians need to do the kind of things that King's is trying to promote and Redeemer and other similar institutions. Not just education, but there's such things as labor organizations and farmers' federations and others trying to think out how do we live responsibly in an increasingly secularized world.
You want to follow up on that?
Well, yes. Now, I think we can do that best in a secular society. It's assumed by many religious people, including our own Lutheran church, but secularism is bad. It's a bad word. Secular society, we don't want society to be secular. But to me, this is a part of the movement of the spirit of history, is that that society becomes more secular, and so it's more open for us to, where no religion has any advantage, and where we work out the spirit of Christ within a secular society. You follow what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So, we need to define what we mean by secular. Secularism, is it a good thing or isn't it? I say it is. I remember reading a book by Arthur Cox, The Secular City, when I was a seminary student. I thought, this is right on. Rather than societies where one or another religion claims to have an advantage over others.
Yeah,
so I agree with
that. What about virulent, a virulent secular state? Let's take Turkey under Kemal.
Mm-hmm.
How does that play? Is that more open, even? Or what's actually happening?
Why did it take a virulent? Was that a reaction to religious? Was it religious fundamentalism and efforts to control through the centuries?
It was a reaction to the breakdown of a religious state, the Ottoman state. Because the Ottoman state, for at least 500 years of its life, had defined itself in religious Islamic Sunni terms. But I want to come back to your point about secularism and the genesis of Christianity. Because as someone who spent 18 years in a Christian institution, I believe I understand that I spent 18 years in a Protestant institution, and I'm not criticizing anyone here, But it was very clear that my Protestant colleagues were somewhat ashamed of talking about their own roots. That they would talk, if they were to talk about Christian history, they would talk only about the past 200 years or so. They would never go down to the first or second century of Christianity. That's to say that I believe that one of the major predicaments of modern Christianity or Christian leaders, that their inability to reinvent universal Christian notions from the first century or so, such as, let's say, the notion of social responsibility or generosity, which is a major motif in the Old Testament and the New Testament and the Quran as well. And so you feel that there's some disconnect between present-day secular Christianity and ancient or traditional Christianity. Now the question is, can secularism help us to bridge the gap between the modern ways of Christianity and the older forms of Christianity?
I'll just say too, I think with regard to the terms have been so loaded, perhaps it's best to avoid them. Secularism, any kind of ism, is come to be suspicious in people's mind. Secular is just a Latin word for the world, and what it means is living in the world. I prefer to use the term civil society just to avoid it, so that we're civil with each other and we learned as a society to respect each other and deal with each other in fashions that show respect. If you want to call that a secular society, okay, but I think in that regard, one of the things that's important for us as religiously minded people as well, whatever our heritage, is to identify the elephant in the room that secularism is a religion, and that when North American society insists on that as the foregone conclusion and approach, and everything else has to accommodate to it, it's become a civil religion with fangs. That we need to identify it for that. It is not neutral. It has a perspective and an opposite perspective to virtually any and all religions. And if we can at least get more people to recognize that who are involved in it, it's more likely to open up civil society that will at least recognize, they'll recognize what they're really dealing with and what we're really dealing with.
Yeah. And actually, Christianity was born in an extremely religious culture and society. It was very religious, and the Christians were, of course, considered atheists because it was so. As were the Jews very often by Romans, and it wasn't a secular society at all. Christianity came into, and perhaps one of the problems in our own world that makes us so divisive. I mean, atheism has nothing to do with Darwin; it has everything to do with Christian hypocrisy and bigotry. And that's one of the biggest issues for people. But I notice when we talk about even Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam, or any of the other religions, what frightens Christians the most is not the things that are different, but the things that are similar in various societies. Because we want to believe in a kind of absolute uniqueness, as if we were outside the formation of the rest of the world and the rest of civilizations. But, you know, during the great axial period, everybody was grappling with the same human problems because everybody is a human being. Mm-hmm. And we all have the same suffering, the same sorrow, the same grief, the same joys, and the same happiness. And people naturally came to some of the same conclusions about how to deal with those common human problems. So recognizing and appreciating the way that other people reach the similar conclusions without thinking that somehow that makes us afraid of them or makes them some kind of an enemy. Not because they're so different, but because there are similarities. And to recognize that people were simply trying to come to grips with common human problems and naturally came to some of the same or similar answers because we're all human beings cut from the same dye. That's...
First, I have to disagree. Secularism, in my mind, is not a religion. It is the ignoring of all other religions. Hence, become a group of people or a way of thinking. You just put all religions aside because of all the problems that religions are causing.
My question is simple. To the panel, what is your advice for the future of this issue, which is separating the religion from the state? Now, we have talked from the Archbishop about an example that happened in Canada. We have listened from Dr. Beaton about an example that happened in the state. We have listened from Dr. Rabi about all what's happening in the Muslim world, what you have then. But now here in Canada, and looking at the future for the global living that we are about to embark upon, what's your advice for the people to take up this issue?
You mean who are they going to choose as the caliph?
You know, among when I go to Syria or someplace, the relationship between Christians and Islam isn't the first thing on my mind. The first thing on my mind is the absolute catastrophe of water and how people are going to survive and how they're going to live. And I think that that could possibly be one of the greatest unifying things that we could that we could do. To say it doesn't matter whether they're Muslims or Hindus or whatever they are, they have a catastrophe. And anyway, the catastrophe of one people is the catastrophe of all humanity. And we have common cause upon which we can build a relationship without ever compromising our faith or our own beliefs. Because all of us essentially are supposed to believe that in humanity. And these common disasters that face humanity should be a point of unity amongst all of us. Mm-hmm. That we don't care. I don't care what religion they are, if they're starving to death, if they don't have water to drink. I mean, that's the issue, isn't it? It's not what doctrine they hold. And we could get our own young people together. I mean, we could bring Muslim and Orthodox and, you know, Calvinist youth together and say, look, this is the cause of all of humanity. And what can we put aside in order to focus on the real issues about the catastrophes of humanity in our era and our time? I mean, we have these tragedies. We might as well make them have a positive side as well. And the positive side would be giving us common cause so we could unite together as fellow human beings without compromising our faith and our religion to focus on those particular issues. I mean, every human being is the image and likeness of God. He created all of us. And they're not two species, one humanity that's not the image and likeness and another that is. And we have to see the image of God in every other human, or we'll never see the face of the living God. And we have common causes that can unite us together. Okay, Christianity has fought amongst itself. Islam, God knows, has fought amongst itself. And the Hindus have been violent, and Tibet has never really been actually a peaceful nation. The monks have always been sort of, you know, busting each other up. But secular society has the same issues. They have the same divisions and the same reasons for killing off the next secular state over. But we, as people who look toward God, as the creator of the universe, have common cause in the suffering of other human beings. And that's the one thing that could truly unite us and give us a common cause that will make us have some respect and reverence for each other. I don't mean just to respect other people's religion, but to have some reverence for it as well. And it's, you know, if I go into a mosque, I take my shoes off and I do my prostration. Of course, we do a lot of prostrations in the Orthodox Church. But, you know, if I wasn't going to respect it, I ought not to be there. And we can certainly learn to have the kind of respect for each other in the face of the tragedies of humanity.
Say something. I would say, in defense of what I said about secularism, secularism is an ideology. Every ideology is religious in root. And it may be opposed to every other religion, but what that shows is kind of a fundamentalist Taliban approach, if we use those kind of terms. But to get to the point of what you asked, I think, which is very important, My first real exposure to interfaith dialogue, as over against ecumenical relations among Christians, was at a conference held in Macedonia just shortly after the fighting ceased in 2001. As a matter of fact, the conference was postponed for six months because the fighting had broken out in the corridor. We'd have to drive from the airport to the capital city of Skopje, where we were going to be meeting. It was a very tense meeting because many of these people had lost families or homes, family members, friends, in the fighting that had broken out. Not, you know, it was similar to what had gone on in Bosnia. But the government of Macedonia had asked people from international backgrounds who were experienced in this to come, and I was privileged to be able to go with some of those who were much more experienced than I. That was a very tense meeting. But what ended up happening, as people from Muslim, Orthodox Christian, Roman Catholic, Jewish, and Protestant backgrounds there in Macedonia met, is an increasing ability to talk with each other. And what they ended up being able to do at the end was set up a council on interreligious cooperation, which has been remarkably successful, given where they were coming from. They actually held joint youth camps between Macedonian Orthodox and Albanian Muslims. That was inconceivable. The seminaries exchanged students and brought profs back and forth to lecture and to talk to each other. They held joint clergy training sessions for dealing with alcoholism and abuse and that sort of thing. Now, we don't do that as readily over here, but do we have to wait until people start killing each other to think it's a good idea? One of the things that struck me at an interfaith event last year that an organization I'm involved with put on in Toronto is to hear an imam, I believe from Calgary, but wherever he was from, say, "We get together with Christian churches and hand out blankets in the cold for the homeless. We take coffee to them." He says, "We're just showing our common humanity and our common love for others." Well, that brings people together and helps them to learn and understand each other and respect each other in ways that are not conflict-laden. But that once you get to know each other, then you can, and respect each other as people, then you can talk more readily about the things on which things you share, the things you differ. But it can promote a greater degree of civility, and that's at least a place to start, from my perspective.
Amen.
We're told, I think the secular narrative, the secular narrative, goes something like this. You know, these sort of superstitious, not quite civilized religious people have these really wonky ideas that they insist upon. They're inherently divisive, these ideas. But they're also, it's also impossible to reconcile them to each other, because they really have nothing to do with any objective truth, right? The classic example is people who talk about the wars of religion as basically being about transubstantiation versus consubstantiation. Yeah. So the secular state then has to step in and say, "Okay, people, right? Calm down. Okay, here's how we can live together." Okay. Basically, what you're talking about are differences of opinion. So, as long as you're able to keep things within the realm of opinion and not truth, then you know you can live together harmoniously, and we will tolerate those kinds of differences. So the idea is that the secular state is a kind of a referee that lays down a certain set of rules for people who have strong differences with each other to get along with each other. And I think what comes through some of the new atheism that we hear from Dawkins, Hitchens, and so forth, you know, they're kind of moving away from that and saying, well, it's about time we stop tolerating. You just told them, get with the program or else, you know, we'll have no choice but to, you know, push you in insane asylums or something like the communists did. But my question is that the only model of, you know, let's say Christians, Muslims, and Jews living together in civility? You know, beautiful word that you used, Jim. Is it the only model that we have to have a secular state to play referee? Or are there other models, other examples of Christians, Muslims, and Jews living together, you know, maybe not perfectly, maybe not entirely harmoniously, but in civility, resolving differences with each other without recourse to some neutral third party? And I'm just interested in hearing if there are models available other than this idea of a secular state.
If I can just comment on that, the finest one that I know of is in Norway in the 1900, where they tolerated one Catholic.
I want to say one of the best examples, though, I've seen of this, this living together with some kind of harmonious understanding, actually has been Syria. And it's technically a secular state, but it's not particularly aggressive that way. But, you know, when the state has the opportunity, it's always going to meddle in religion because it wants to get where the votes are. And, you know, but secular state like capitalism will use, abuse, and misuse anyone it can to get power. And it's, consequently, there has to be some kind of a real separation between church and state for the church to even have its, you know, a voice. And both secularism and religion fall into what Alfred North Whitehead would call the fallacy of misplaced concreteness, that we believe there are absolutes. There are no absolutes. Absolute is not a synonym for truth. It's a synonym for a frozen mind or a dictatorship. There isn't a synonym for truth. There are no absolutes in the human condition. No black and white. They're all shades of gray in the human condition. And because religion, when we focus on dogmatizing every aspect of human existence, and as the scholastics did, dogmatizing every facet of science, then we can't possibly be proclaiming the truth. All we can be is proclaiming an ideology. And that's something that Christians have got to get beyond, and Islam as well. And secular states, you know, need to get beyond it as well. But you can see the political divide, particularly in the United States, between two completely different visions of what the gospel is in it. And you can see it in the debates about health care. Health care is anti-Christian to some people because it takes care of people that God obviously hasn't blessed because they're poor. And if God loved them, they wouldn't be poor. But, you know, God blesses the rich because, never mind the fact that they're the ones who can afford to commit the worst possible crimes and hire a lawyer to get them off, and the poor can't. But, I mean, those kinds of civil state ideologies as well. Okay, a civil state that that stays out of religion, and a religion that agrees to stay out of the politics of the civil state and try to have some kind of moral influence. And by moral influence, I mean things like the healthcare system, not persecuting somebody you think is immoral.
Historically, there's at least one example that points in a direction but also has its limitation. In Andalusia, in Muslim Spain, Christians, Jews, and Muslims lived together in a certain kind of coexistence that was pretty good. Now, technically, according to the structures that the Muslim empires had set up, Muslims were of the first class and everybody else was the second class. You had to pay a head tax. Certain other prohibitions were instituted on you. And the situation was, though, that those were often not enforced. Once you paid your taxes, and, you know, once you paid your tax, basically things were pretty open. Periodically, the privilege was reasserted by one or another Muslim leader, and it became problematic. People took some umbrage at the change of what had taken place. I think we have, as far as I know, yet to see a situation where peoples of different religious heritages were living together and the majority group willingly did a canonic act and set aside the power that their numbers would allow them to have. I think if, for those of us who are Christians who recognize that Christ gave up the free exercise of his Godhead to become incarnate, that tells us something. And if we are willing to do that in Canada, we might be able to set up a situation in which we could genuinely work. I think for all reasons, for the foreseeable future, those who at least have a Christian heritage are continuing going to outnumber those who are of other religious heritages, whoever they practice. But are we willing to set aside the privilege that might give us in order to accept others? I hope so, but I am not convinced it's going to happen.
If I may comment only briefly, it is true that there have been historical models like in Andalusia or in the Ottoman world or in the Mughal Empire in India that one can talk about coexistence in the case of South Asia, not only between Jews, but between Muslims, Christians, and Hindus, and Buddhists also to a smaller extent. So one can talk about a number of historical models, but the question is, can we reinvent the historical models at the present time? This is one. And second, can we escape the notion and the ideology of the nation state being part of a nation or an empire nowadays if you are part of the U.S. empire? And what's disturbing about, you know, the 20th century to my mind is that we witness perhaps for the first time in history, due to the advance in technology, a large-scale genocide of people, not only of Jews like in World War I and World War II, because of the nation state and the advance in technology and the rise of fascism in that sense in the European context. Whereas perhaps in the pre-modern model of the state, we don't witness such emergence of fascism. Like even in India nowadays, you know, the genocide directed against the Muslims in 2002 or the Christians, especially the Catholics, although the state of India is secular, democratic in nature, but this type of genocide did not take place in the pre-modern Mughal model, you know, before the 19th century or so. So these are problems that we have to look at from different perspectives.
You know, that's always been a problem, and a little bit of a problem with Orthodox Christians who came to North America, identified themselves with the country they came from. And it, in order to be Serbian, you have to be Orthodox. It doesn't mean you have to believe. It doesn't mean you have to have anything to do at all. And I think something like 24% or something like that of Serbs in Serbia are actually religious. But they're Orthodox because they're Serbs.
Yeah.
And you have to be. And that's part of that issue, part of that problem, locking ourselves to our own
natural. The purpose of baptism, right?
Baptize
to become a Serb.
Yeah.
Well, somebody's going to marry a Serb. You have to baptize her and make her a Serb.
Yeah.
Or
one last. Yes, I'd like to go back to what Christian was talking about, the model for Christianity, or whatever he mentioned it. The three. Groups that are with us this evening, through the history, there have been lots of splits, schisms, splinter groups breaking off, being fairly, for all the history, but two have been able to right some of these wrongs without splinter bloodshed. But then, Mr. Akiva, I was listening that you had said that generally the Muslim world is quite together, let's call it that way. Most of the countries that you mentioned follow the Quran and live in general harmony, but we do have the group that follows more of the Surrey that Mohammed brought down, and we see a lot of bloodshed, a lot of misery, a lot of hate, especially towards the state of Israel. And my question then is, we need to fix that from within. Can the Muslim world get back to a Quran God-centered model?
Are you addressing me?
Yeah, he is, and it's nice always to have such a softball question.
I think that you must have misunderstood my presentation. But anyway, if we are to talk about Israel and all of that, Israel is the creation of modern Zionism, and Zionism is a secular ideology of the Jewish nation state that was invented in the 19th century, in the high age of nationalism in Europe. And if you look at the narrative history of Zionism, most religious Jews, until more or less 1967, opposed Zionism on religious principles, because religious Jews had believed that a state of the Jews could not be established until the Messiah came back. And Zionism is not the Messiah of the Jewish people, although it claims to be nowadays. But Zionism, of course, created a state of Israel at the expense of another nation, not only Muslims, but Christians also. Because the refugees who became refugees in 1948 were not only Muslims. They were Christian refugees, Palestinian refugees, Muslim Palestinians who became refugees. So I would not see that the conflict is between Muslims and Jews per se. That would be a reductionist attitude. In addition, if you look at the whole relationship between Jews and Muslims from the beginning of Islam in the 7th century, Jews and Muslims had lived in more or less cordial terms. And take the major Zionist authority on that, Bernard Lewis, in his book Semites and Anti-Semites, where he talks about the close relationships between Jews and Muslims, not only in Spain, in Muslim Spain, but in North Africa, in Egypt, in Iran, in Yemen, and so on and so forth. And nowadays, because of the tragic Arab-Israeli conflict and the history of Zionism, we look at Jewish-Muslim relations only from the prism of Zionism and the relationship between the Zionism and the Arabs. So the question is not between Islam and Judaism. It is between Zionism as an ideology of a nation and between the Palestinians, who happen to be Palestinian Muslims, Palestinian Christians, and Palestinian Jews, because there have been Palestinian Jews. Take the Samaritans in Nablus. We know the Samaritans from Western history, but there is a small group of Jews living in Nablus in the occupied West Bank, Samaritans, who speak a certain form of Hebrew that is not spoken in Israel, and who speak Arabic in addition, but who define themselves as Palestinians, and who don't want to join Israel. They refuse to accept Israeli citizenship and Israeli passports. That's a big issue. But there's no doubt that Zionism has done so much harm to Muslim-Jewish relations. And Zionism is a Western creation, no doubt about it.
Secular creation, interestingly
enough.
Yeah.
I followed some of that drift, but you weren't listening, and maybe I didn't explain it correctly, but in my reading and understanding is that the survey...
Sharia, you mean?
Surah.
Islamic law?
No, I'm speaking about the surahs in the Quran.
Surahs. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So whatever Muhammad proclaimed back in 600 A.D., okay, he fought the Jewish state in Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. Okay? And from that, the splinter part of the Muslim nations followed Muhammad... want to annihilate any Jewish state and any Western country that...
Okay, I get it. First of all, we did not have Saudi Arabia at the time. Saudi Arabia is a modern invention. We did not have Saudi Arabia at the time. It was Medina, Hijaz. It was Arabia, not Saudi Arabia. Because Saudi Arabia is a modern nation state. But anyway, the point is that if Muslims wanted to annihilate Jews, they had at least 1400 years to do so, and they did not do so. Because most of the Jews of the world lived in a Muslim context until the 16th century, number-wise. And when the New World, so to speak, was discovered, Jews began to migrate to the New World. But most Jews of the world, number-wise, 70% of the Jews of the world, had lived in a Muslim context. And to speak about annihilation, Muslims could have easily annihilated Jews and Christians if they wanted to. But they did not. Why? Because of the ethic of Islam. That's one. Now you're referring to the conflict in Medina between the Prophet and the Jewish tribes of Medina. To say that Jews were a nation then, that's also an oxymoron, because the nation is a modern creation. The Jewish tribes in Medina were Arab Jewish tribes. And it was a conflict between different Arab tribes, between the tribe of the Prophet and other Arab tribes that happened to be Jewish. And I'd like to refer you to a major book on that by the American historian Charles Torrey, The Jewish Foundation of Islam. He makes other claims, but the point here is that Jews were not annihilated. Jews accepted Islam, and to a large extent it was because of their acceptance that Islam was able to expand in what we call the Middle East. So when Muslims conquered Jerusalem in 638 AD, the Muslim army that came from Medina was headed by Jewish converts to Islam, and that's why the Jewish community of Jerusalem accepted them. There is an intrinsic historical and spiritual relationship between Judaism and Islam that few people nowadays talk about because of the conflict between Zionism and the Arabs. But that intrinsic relationship concerns what we call the Aqsa Mosque, or the Temple Mount. And Muslims intended to build a mosque over the Temple Mount, and that tells you about the intrinsic spiritual relationship between Judaism and Islam that a few people talk about.
Okay. Thanks so much. No, yeah. Just hold on. We must bring this to an end. You can chat afterwards, okay? I wanted to thank Kings for their lovely hospitality and and all of you for coming. I want to mention a couple things to you and then thank our speakers. On Thursday, the 5th, at 7 o'clock, the Ryan Center is bringing a wonderful poet, Tim Lilburn, who's going to be at Greenwood Bookshop doing a reading from his recent work and reflecting on poetry in the Canadian landscape. Tim Lilburn is, I think, one of Canada's leading, well, not only poets, but thinkers about, I guess, what I would call the spiritual meaning of place. Also, to follow up on the concerns of our colleague here, on Thursday, November 19th, we will be having a lecture at Augustana and Camrose that you're all invited to, on the Palestinian Israeli conflict and prospects for a peaceful resolution. I would encourage you to come and continue the thinking on that. And then finally, in December, which is not all that far away, the 3rd of December, we'll be here at King's speaking about Christian orthodoxy and modern science. You will also be doing a philosopher's cafe. We have one this coming Saturday at 1 o'clock at Steve's restaurant near the university, on theology and mystery, which I will be animating, and then Vidika Lazar on the 5th of December on prayer and mental sanity. Vidika Lazar has been looking at the new literature on the brain and thinking about how prayer has been a way for the human family, for bringing health to human beings over centuries. So I would like to thank Archbishop Lazar, Professor Mechen, and Professor Abu Rabi for this evening, and you for coming. Thanks so much.